Howdy, writers! KJ here, staring ahead into fall 2021 and trying to ignore the fact that it feels like staring into the abyss. Stop. Wait. That's really not where I meant to go with that. What I want to focus on is the other part of fall. Crunchy leaves, pumpkins, apples, school supplies, fresh starts. If that's the part of fall you want more of, maybe it's time for a new beginning as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator say they begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and often end up being booked months in advance. Sound like fun? Agreed. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay. About, you know, 5 or 10 minutes definitely talking about the bus thing and want to make sure that people know how to fund you. And does the GoFundMe expire, by the way? Okay. Because we want to make sure we get this out before your GoFundMe expires. So, okay. Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about this. Okay, so a second of silence for our producer. Hey, this is Jess, and you have landed on the hashtag AmWriting podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about all things books, all things writing. We talk about querying, pitching, illustration. What else do we talk about? Nonfiction proposals. We talk about outlining fiction books. We talk about everything, all the nuts and bolts stuff about getting your work down on the page, getting the work out there, just generally getting the work done. Today, I'm on my own because I'm doing an interview with two friends of mine that I am so excited to talk about. I met this couple, Robbie Bear and Matthew Swanson, a bunch of years ago at Mom 2.0, where, by the way, I don't think we've even mentioned this yet, but this podcast won Podcast of the Year at the Iris Awards, which are the Mom 2.0 awards for content, and we're so excited. But I met Robbie and Matthew at Mom 2.0. They were giving a presentation about writing and illustrating as a couple, and they rocked my world. They're amazing, amazing people, kind and generous and lovely. And I think you'll find that out during this interview, but I would love to introduce you to them now. Hello, you two, you lovely people.
My goodness, I hope we live up to this tremendous introduction.
Well,
I'm smiling.
Yeah. So he's so overwhelmed. He doesn't have anything to say for once.
A little bit of mistiness in my
just
eye.
Just hold on to this moment because he will be full of words very shortly.
All right,
well, one of the things that Serena Bowen does when she introduces herself for this podcast, which of course I completely forgot to do. Hi, I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the new book, The Addiction Inoculation. And you can find my work at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Atlantic. Okay, phew, there, I'm done. Okay, Serena, in her introduction, often talks about the fact that she has now written over 35 books. And by the way, this is not usually part of her introduction, but she just landed her 20th book on the USA Today bestseller list.
Wow.
I know. She's insane. But I happen to know that you have a number that could rival that. I know you have over 60 like self-pub books, and I don't even know how many published books through traditional publishing.
That's a good question. I think we're around 11 published through traditional publishing and 13 or 14 or 15 more to come, depending on how you count it. We've got new books in the works, some announced, some not. So
hold on. These numbers are scaring me a little bit. I haven't been keeping track.
Yeah, Rob, I
got my nose to the grindstone when he says 15 more. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Not 15 more, 15 total.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
that's different than 15
I
more.
May have misspoken. Anyway, yes. The point is we're busy. We are working. I'm the writer in our outfit. Robbie is the illustrator. So my work comes first in our collaboration.
Yes.
One time we made a book where Robbie went
when
first.
When we self-published.
Oh.
I went first, and I just drew a bunch of pictures, and then Matthew tried to write a story around it. And we discovered that is not the way that we work best together.
That is
interesting.
Not the,
So the way it works is that Matthew does the writing and then Robbie comes in and swoops in. Now, when you say illustrations, I have to clarify what we're talking about because, yes, they do beautiful picture books like what you would think of. They have my three favorites, I think, are Everywhere Wonder and Babies Ruin Everything. And I think I hate to pick a favorite, guys. I really hate to pick a favorite. But Sunrise Summer, I think, is just, it's spectacular. And part of that is the nonfiction geek in me because of at the end of the book, there's this beautiful explainer about sort of what it is Robbie and Matthew do every summer, which for the audience, what is it that you do every summer?
Yes. So ever since I was 1.5 years old, my family has been traveling to the Alaskan tundra to go commercial salmon fishing. That is our family business, our summer family business. So I've been doing that for 45 years. And Matthew started, now it's been like 20 years ago?
I met Robbie when I was 25 years old. And a few weeks later, she introduced me to her mother. And a few months after that, I was dragged to the Alaskan
and my
tundra.
Father. They were both there.
They were both there. But really, your mother was the big deal. She dragged me 4,000 miles to the Alaskan tundra, clad me head to toe in rubber pants elbow length rubber gloves, and I was expected to jump into the Bering Sea and pull fish out of nets with my bare hands. I am a young man from the plains of Kansas. This was very unfamiliar. I was incredibly nervous. I spilled lots of water. I didn't know it at the time.
You did a fine job.
But it was husband auditions, and I'm frankly shocked that I passed and was allowed to marry Robbie. But I did. I've been back 17 times since then. I've spent most of the past decade as the tundra nanny, where my job is making macaroni and cheese and banging pots and pans together to frighten the grizzly bears away from the compound when children are on their way to the outhouse. It's a very important work to which I am well suited. Robbie is the primary fisherman in our outfit.
Yes. So Sunrise Summer is a picture book about that experience, sort of written through the eyes of our daughter who was starting out on her first summer as part of the actual fishing crew doing the job of fishing when she was around, I don't know, 10, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and I alerted Lenore Skenazy to this book because she is the free range parents person and helps run a website called Let Grow. And that book is just, I mean, that may be the other reason that this book is one of my favorites, is that through the eyes of your daughter, you get to see her try all sorts of things that in the real world, in the world here, people would say, oh no, you couldn't possibly do that. It's way too dangerous. I mean, let alone the grizzly bears, but, you know, driving the four-wheeler and all that sort of stuff. So it's just, I love that book so much. But getting back to my point, so, you know, there are these picture books, what you would expect, you know, husband writes the words, wife does these gorgeous illustrations. But then there are other series, The Real McCoys and The Cookie Chronicles, Ben Yokoyama and the Cookie of Endless Waiting, where I think I heard one time, Robbie, that I heard a 9 at the beginning of the number, and I don't want to say 900 because I'm hoping it's not 900, but like illustrations in one of the Real McCoys books. There was a ridiculous number of illustrations around the text.
I think I estimated that there's about 3 illustrations per page in The Real McCoys. It's about 330 pages long.
So 900 more than 900. So I happen to love the illustration. So these are sort of middle grade books, fantastic chapter book reading for your middle grade kid, eking up into middle school, definitely. I love them so much.
Aww.
So can we talk? We've talked to writing partners before, but they're usually people who live thousands of miles away from each other and they trade chapters back and forth. So how early in your marriage did you figure out this might be something you're interested in doing? And how has it borne out over years of working together? And how are you still married and haven't killed each other?
My first contact with Robbie's art was we went to college together, and there was a show that was doodles from people's sketchbooks, marginalia,
on our notebooks.
And there was this drawing of Walt Whitman that was created in negative space. And I said, I love that. And it was Robbie's. And I didn't know Robbie at the time. We weren't friends. But I remember seeing it and loving her style at that very point. When we first got together, we just liked each other. And we didn't realize that we were creatively compatible and that we might be able to make work together. And it wasn't until You were applying to grad
school? I was applying
to
grad school. So we had been together for a couple years. Mm-hmm. I was applying to grad school for illustration because I figured that's what I wanted to do. And Matthew was auditing a class, a creative writing class. So he was spending his evenings writing these weird little short stories. And I was like, I need something to illustrate for my application. Can you, like, give me some of your stories and I'll see what I can do? And his writing style at the time was very, he didn't pay attention to, like, the important things that one pays attention to in writing. Since we're talking to writers, you all will appreciate that Matthew's writing had no plot. It had no, like, description of anything. It was just these sort of
voices. What happened there?
Yeah, it's just voice. They were just strictly voice.
They were non-linear musings on a topic. They were
which makes them sound very dull, but they were also very funny.
They were funny and weird, yeah. But they needed help to become a story. And what we really loved was working together to say, here is this piece of text that we both find intriguing. What can Robbie add to make it stitch together with the surrounding chunks of intriguing text to create a narrative and also to tell a more complete story? So we've always loved the idea of pictures and words interlocking in a way that both are indispensable and interdependent. And so that's how we got started. And we made this very strange book called A Bully Named Chuck, which is, I don't know, like 180 pages long. Very
it's kind
strange
of about
format,
adolescence
like
and
the hinge moment yeah. between adolescence and adulthood. And we thought we had hung the moon. This book was going to be a bestseller.
Change the world.
But we didn't know how to make a book at the time. And we got so tired after hand cutting four copies of it and stitching it together with dental floss. That was it. We gave a copy to our parents and our best friends and they all looked at us funny.
Well, we sent one to some not publisher. I think
we gave it to my creative writing professor, who I think maybe
handed
sent it
to his agent, who was like, "Okay, nice,
yeah,
good
he was
job,
being,
guys."
People
he was
have always been nice to us, Jess.
I mean, we sent it to our parents, and our parents were like, "Okay, thanks, I guess." I mean, there was the reception was not as great as we had thought it would be.
What was important though was that we figured out we loved this thing, and that moment on, we said we want to make books together.
This is what we
want to
do
when we grow up, and we kept waiting to grow up, and we never grew up. We got jobs, but the jobs kept us from having time to make books, and so eventually we got really tired of not making books. I applied to grad school with hopes of Robbie got her MFA in the midst of all this. I thought that maybe that would be the great moment that would unleash me as a writer. I applied to 6 of the finest MFA programs in all the land, Jess, and I got 7 letters of rejection because the University
I'm
of Minnesota
sorry.
Rejected me on consecutive Mondays. They sent me the same letter on consecutive Mondays, as
oh,
if to be
impressive.
Emphatic, right?
Yeah, that's very impressive. Well, I will share with you that actually some of our listeners know that I applied. I entered something in a writing contest that had a really cool prize, and I had an idea around the topic. And I found out this morning that I did not win said prize.
What?
I know.
Well, I hope that you get rejected again
next
by
the same
Wednesday.
People.
Yes.
I know. And so if I only get rejected once, that's like a win.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly. You've done better than Matthew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So grad school was off the table. And so we sort of had this backup plan that was that we would sell our house, quit our jobs, sell our belongings. We had a little bit of a nest egg, enough to live on for a year. And we did all that. And we moved into the hayloft of my mom's pottery studio, which is downstairs. And we were just going to live here for a year, make books together, you know, as much as we possibly could just to say that we had, and then either apply to grad school the next year and hopefully get in that time or return to, you know, careers. Matthew was working as a writer for a design firm and I was working as a designer there. So we had skills, you know, this was now 10 years out of college. We had skills that we knew we could rely on to get jobs if this didn't work out. And Matthew actually, the big secret is that Matthew went back to that job. Mm-hmm. And so he has that job. He had that job half-time from home throughout all of our self-publishing. And that's the reason why we could afford to do all the self-publishing just without making any money at it.
Yeah, my part of our collaboration goes more quickly than Robbie's. So I was able to write the books, do the job half-time while Robbie devoted herself full-time to illustration. That first year of self-publishing, we self-published 10 books because that's what we set out to do. We mm-hmm. set up a subscription service where people could, you know, send
this
us 50.
This was like back in 2006.
I signed yeah. up for that, and it had gone by the wayside and had not been removed from your website yet.
Oh, oops, no. It's still
I was very excited. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. At some point, we're going to hire some people to just reboot it because we have enough stuff that we could do a subscription for several years for people. But we, just,
if I'm correct, it was called Bobbledy Books. Is
yes,
that right?
Yes, that was the kids yeah. there. So that we had two subscription services. So the first we started was called Idiots Books, and that was picture books for adults. So a little hard to market.
They were very strange.
Weird, yeah. Very strange. And we had the people who got the subscriptions. I mean, there were people who loved them. But they also were like, I don't know who to give this to. Like, I'd love to support you guys, but there's really nobody else I know who would like these. But a
That's
lot of them said...
That's just the kind of broad market that an agent and a publicist really want to hear about.
So, but we never had intentions of being commercially right. published authors. That was never really our dream or our goal. We started with Idiots Books. Then we created Bobbledy Books when we started having children, thinking, oh, maybe we should make
also,
books for children.
I mean, also... People told us, they said, your books are weird. If you made books for little kids, I know like a million little kids I would buy them for. Right. Which we were like, cash cow, let's do it. And then we did it and nobody signed up the millions of kids. But that's okay.
In the midst of all this, we started a letterpress design studio for a couple of years. We kept throwing a lot of ideas at the wall to see what would stick. We were also very purposeful about going to small press shows and setting up a table and standing behind the table and connecting with people and trying to share our self-published books. And those shows led to a couple of connections that proved really meaningful. We never knew at the moment that the connection was important. But at one show, we sold one of our books with a very eccentric format. It's a mix and match format where panels recombine to make the narrative and the illustrations recombine with other pieces.
Sort of like an Exquisite Corpse
yeah.
kind of thing.
So we sold a book to a guy who worked for Disney at the time. Disney was partnering with Little Brown to make Marvel superhero books called the Superhero Squad series. So this guy took this book of ours to a production meeting at Little Brown.
2 years later.
2 years later. Our editor, the person who became our editor, Aaron Stein, said, oh, I'm looking for someone to work in that format. I'll give those guys a call. She gave us a call. We connected with her. We made a book called The Superhero Squad Flips Out, in which we were given top secret dossiers with information about all your favorite Marvel superheroes as children. So in this book series, Wolverine is not allowed to injure anybody with his adamantium claws. He can use them to, like, open letters or cut birthday cake.
Yeah.
So it was fun. I wrote 10 little
vignettes. Matthew wrote his vignettes.
My little vignettes. Robbie did her illustrations.
I wasn't allowed to actually draw any of the Marvel superheroes. I had clip art that I was allowed to use.
It was a work-for-hire project.
Yeah.
So our names appeared in maybe 3 or 4 point type in the back, so small that my father could not find them and accused us not of having created the book. But the point is, we worked really hard. We put forth a good product. We took advantage of that opportunity. And Aaron Stein, our editor, said, I like you guys. Let's work together to try to get one of your projects ready for the market. And that is what turned into Baby Zoo and Everything. It was one of our self-published books. She loved the title. She said, that is a book that I can sell on the title alone for this very niche market of people having second children. Let's do that. And so that was our entry into the world of people actually paying you to make books.
That must be pretty exciting for, you know, if an agent or an editor or even a publicist, if they like the work that someone produces and then those people come forward and say, yeah, we got 60 of these hidden in a cabinet. And yeah, that's pretty cool. So how did the chapter book stuff start? How did you move into the middle grade market?
It's funny, Matthew consistently throughout all of our work together before that said, I don't have a novel, like a long length piece of writing in me. So I can't remember.
I lived with a narrative of fear, Jess. I just thought I did not have the capacity to do it. And one morning I woke up and I was playing with the voice that popped into my head of this very energetic, self-confident, somewhat deluded 10-year-old girl.
I really
like what she had to say, and in fact, it is autobiographical. That is entirely me. Moxie and I are the same. And so it was very easy to write her story, and I say this to kids when they ask, where do you get your ideas? And it always drives Robbie crazy. but I find the character I fall in love with, and then I get out of the way and I follow that character around and see what they do and see what they say. And that usually leads to a disorganized mess, but it leads to a disorganized mess that I can follow in pursuit of a story. So I didn't know how to write a novel when we pitched The Real McCoys to Erin Stein. She said to me, she said to us, I like this very much. This is a one-note story. We need to add a second plot. We need to add more surprise. I love the voice. Will you work with me to make it a better book? And once again, she gave us this opportunity to realize our potential. It sounds so hackneyed. But like, she saw that we could do this, and she was willing to work with us to make it work. And it did, and we love how it turned out.
And
when you sold those, did you sell those as a series?
We sold the first two books, and then on the strength of the book one, got a lot of critical response. It got some really nice reviews, and so Erin then was able to buy a book three, and so it's a trilogy now. I've written book four because that's what I do, and I hope that someday we are able to publish it as well. What were you going
to
say?
I just wanted to say that to go back to the very beginning of your process, Matthew, mm-hmm. And this I think might be interesting to writers. Matthew set himself a goal at one point, a year before the piece of Moxie writing came out, mm-hmm. to write 1,000 words every day. Mm. And so every morning he would get up really early in the morning and just start writing, and he would write his 1,000 words. And because you were sort of just like writing, mm-hmm. you got, he talks about this too. You should talk about how when your brain doesn't, wake up. And
Jess, have you or have your readers heard of this, the most dangerous writing app? You probably know of something like this. It's called Dangerous. All right. So Google that.
Okay.
And then an interface will pop up that looks like a sort of Microsoft Word window.
Okay.
And you set a time limit. And then you start typing. And if you stop typing for more than 2 or 3 seconds, your words start fading away.
This is like free writing that I make my students do all the time, where you just got to keep the words coming.
Well, this nice. App disciplines you because you face the abject terror of seeing your words go away. If they fade away, they're gone.
Gosh.
You don't get them back. So you have to keep writing. You just have to keep writing, and you get past that place where you are saying, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, this story stinks. And at the end of any piece of writing that you approach with any degree of presence, there's going to be nuggets of delight embedded therein that you probably won't even be able to see until a few days later. So the practice I recommend is getting up. For me, getting up before the judgy part of my brain is awake.
Mm-hmm.
Allows the creative part of my brain to have a little more freedom and a little more leash, right? So for me, the creative part wakes up earlier than the judgy part. So I get up at 5, I sit down at my computer. If I'm working on a project, I work on the project. If I'm looking for a new project, I write with no agenda or ambition, and ideally no judgment. And I feel like this is a practice I've developed. And the more I know that I can produce good work, the less pressure I put on myself to produce good work every time, because it's not going to happen every time, but it'll happen eventually. And every time you write, something good happens. So
I love this. We will definitely put the most dangerous writing app in the show notes that anyone can find it. That is incredibly cool. Although I have to say, it would really stress me out, I think, the fading thing at first.
It does. It stresses you out the way a loving partner says, you can do it. You could do it. You have to do it. No, maybe it doesn't work for people who don't fear losing their words. But for me, there's no greater fear than losing something that I've written. So it really motivates me.
I love the fact that there are a lot of things that over the years that I've gotten to know you that you do, you like to do things on a regular basis. You have a daily minute that you put out there in the world every day. That is just hysterical and funny. And I think I tune in maybe a couple times a week. I love it. I love the fact that there's this thing I can expect from you guys every day. It's really lovely.
For the record, Matthew likes to do things on a regular basis. Robbie is a total hot mess and just goes along with the Daily Minute because Matthew reminds her every day. So yeah, I think we provide very, very tippy ends of a seesaw. He is on the extreme, like, organized, gets his homework in 3 weeks early, and I'm on the extreme opposite end. of very disorganized.
If it were just me, yeah. or if there were two of me in our partnership, we would just be a charbroiled heap of smoldering sadness. Like, we'd burn ourselves into a tizzy instantly. If it were two Robbies, we'd still be working on our third book instead of our 84th. So, like, somewhere in the middle, we balance each other out. And it also really helps that we have just completely complementary skill sets and completely complementary ways of approaching problems. And I think the great challenge over the years has been accepting that we have very different approaches and learning how to leverage that to our advantage instead of frustrating us. And we've sometimes come to points where we're frustrated with each other because we look at things completely differently. But it's actually a strength and not a weakness if we
have, although we've gone for a while without one of these meetings. We have meetings like every month or so. We used to have meetings every month where Matthew would be like, oh my God, what is your problem? And I would be like, oh my God, stop breathing down my neck. And it would just be like, and then everything blows up. And then the next day we have to like show back up at the desk and get back to work and pretend everything's okay.
Well, to your point, like how do we still look at each other after all these years of spending like 99% of our time together?
And I have to point out, your loft is not a massive space. I mean, you work and live in a very small space. I mean, ingeniously laid out, and the studio is kind of just a dream, amazing space. Yes. But it's not massive. It's not a big space. You can't really go off to the office and get away from each other.
No. For the first 13 years, we worked on opposite sides of the same room. And just recently, I realized that the dusty storage room could be converted into an office. So I actually have my own writing room now. And that has been a really good development, I think, for us each to have our own space. But we did spend a huge amount of time.
We also have four children, which we didn't mention.
Right.
But there are those
I was getting, believe me, I was getting to that.
Before we leave the topic of collaboration, I want to point out that Robbie is a fantastic editor. And all of our self-publishing, she was my only editor. Now that I work with professional editors, I absolutely value what they bring to the table, but Robbie's always my first editor. So I was asked by our actual editor at Random House to submit a sort of proposal for a new book in our current series. And I wrote it and I liked it, but then Robbie gave me incredible feedback and made it better. She breathed more of me into it. She helped me access some of my own weirdness that was missing because I was thinking about it very clinically. So Robbie helps me be a better version of myself by reflecting me back during the writing process. And I,
you
should say this part, but I mean, I also...
Matthew does the same for me.
Ditto back.
Yes.
But I mean, so for example, The Real McCoys is 37,000 words long. I took it upon myself to write illustration ideas for Robbie before she illustrated it the first time. And I put little sticky notes in the InDesign document.
Thanks, Matthew.
Well, let me tell you, I wrote 42,000 words worth of notes on a 37,000 word manuscript, thinking I would be incredibly helpful to Robbie. It didn't turn out
I think
to
I
be
maybe
as
took
useful.
Maybe 1,000 words of those notes to heart, so and the rest we chucked.
It's always a balance. It's always a balance. How can we be most useful to one another? How can we best bring out the best in each other?
But I do want to say that the practice, you know, when I think of where you started with your writing, with no plot, Matthew was a very emotional writer, I think. You just wrote from...
Intuitive,
that's what I mean.
Intuitive. Mm-hmm.
There's the words guy.
I'm an emotional
guy.
Person.
There's the words guy coming through.
But I'm an intuitive writer.
An intuitive writer. Mm. So he would just write, and that first book, A Bully Named Chuck, most of the time we spent discussing the manuscript, we were talking about, like, what is it that you're trying to say here with this? Like, this is such an interesting thought, but, like, what is the actual point of what you're trying to say? So deconstructing the text was a lot of the process of his early writing. And I think over the course of our working together, and then over the course of actually commercially publishing with an editor, with a real editor who knows how to construct a book, one of the things that was such a struggle for Matthew, I think, in the transition, was that he had to, like, explain to people what he was going to do before he was going to do it. Mm. And previously, in all of our self-publishing, he just got to write whatever he wrote, and then we could figure out what it was about afterwards. So having to make a book proposal where you're saying, what this book is going to be about. That's a tricky thing when you know that it's going to come out and it's going to be great, but you actually have to have a plan for it ahead of time. So I think our 10 years of self-publishing were absolutely crucial to the success that we've had commercial publishing. That was like years and years of MFA training, I think, for us working together to figure out how it is that we make books together, how it is that Matthew writes, how it is that I fit into the equation. All of that stuff seems like a silly, like our self-publishing could be a silly vanity project. Like you could see it as that. And I think most people did because it was a silly vanity project. But it really absolutely taught us the skills that we use all the time in our commercial publishing stuff. So for anyone who thinks that whatever they're doing is silly and is not useful because it's not making you money, it is useful. And it's teaching you something and it's moving you forward. So, yeah.
Absolutely. We call, especially the things that you're sort of looking to call failures or looking to call a waste of time, we refer to those as tuition. You know, that's something that has really, you know, it's worth it because you learn something from that, even if it was a major, you know, a major failure. But in terms of the proposal, I totally get you on the proposal thing. I mean, for me, I can't know what a book is going to look like until I've done all the research, which means I can't write the proposal for the book until most of the research that's the part of writing the book is, and then it changes anyway. So, you know, but it is, for me anyway, a worthwhile exercise in that it helps give shape to the book in my head. And at least I have little ropes to hang to instead of just flying and hoping I catch on to something. Have you found has that process changed for you, Matthew? Has it become easier?
Yes, it has. And every new novel length book I write, I think the machine inside of me that knows how to think that way gets a little bit more sophisticated and a little bit more sturdy. So
does Moxie actually, do you do proposals for like the Moxie books? And do you have to do like chapter summaries, or are you just doing like an overall, these are the shenanigans Moxie's going to get up to?
It's funny. It's more of the latter. It's more of the broad brush arc and not a chapter summary. But with each new book I propose, I find that I am being a little bit more specific and a little more structured about it because I'm able to think in that way in advance.
And also, you know, we now have a different editor at Penguin Random House for the Cookie Chronicles, Catherine Harrison. And I think Matthew has now learned ahead of time what the response to a particular piece of writing might be. He now has his two different editors' voices in his heads. You only have one head.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
His head.
You're my other head, Robbie.
and so a lot of times he'll show me something and I'll give him feedback. And he was like, I totally heard, you know, Catherine saying that. And I just was hoping that it wasn't obvious. But no, that's absolutely something she would say. So
having a collaborator that knows you well helps you avoid the laziness to which you might otherwise be prone. There are times when I do exactly what Robbie just said, and I say, hopefully no one will notice this. I know this could be better, but I just don't know how to fix it. But she always smells the part of my writing that is suspicious and will point it out and hold me to my own best standards. And that's really useful.
And the same is true for the illustrations. I often will get lazy and be like, that clearly looks like a dinosaur. And Matthew will be like, that doesn't really look like a dinosaur. So,
and we've both gotten better at shortening the amount of time we pout after being told to improve our work. So
before we move on to a topic that I'm really excited about, which is your next big project, I do have to say, Matthew, it's my understanding that you do serve an essential role right before things are due, because if I'm understanding this correctly, Robbie will pull all-nighters. Robbie likes to really work down to the wire, and Matthew is the purveyor of snacks. Correct me if I'm wrong on this.
Go for it, Rob.
Matthew is absolutely the purveyor of snacks. I would die of malnutrition as my deadline approaches if Matthew weren't available to serve me platters of preserved meats, usually, and buckets and buckets of Coke. And cheeses
Yes,
and cheese. Fruits.
And sometimes some very, very fine, oh, high cacao count chocolate.
There, right? There's, yes, some candy there's in the there. I've seen that.
I forgot. Yeah. I forgot about all the candy. Yeah.
I am fueled by the anxiety.
Brain food, Robbie. It is brain food.
Exactly.
Sugar for the brain. The brain takes up like 80% of your sugar intake or something
well,
like that.
There
don't
you
take
go.
Me,
that
don't
actually
take my
makes
word
sense.
For it.
That does make sense.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, I am fueled by avoiding the anxiety of being anywhere near a deadline. And Robbie is fueled by the anxiety of being near a deadline. It's one of the ways
the anxiety
we're most
opposite. Of missing the deadline, but like at the moment that the deadline happens.
But you like that intensity of that last
minute. You know, I have said
right?
this before, and I think it's true, that there are some people who would be great to have around when the house is on fire because they will just be like, dang it, it's pressure time, I know what to do. That's me. Matthew will keep the house from catching on fire. He will set the fire alarms, he will do all the things. I'm the person who will, know the things to take out of the fire and save the cat and that kind of stuff.
To illustrate that point, I actually will make my own deadlines by telling my agent that I hope to have XYZ to her by next Friday because I need deadlines so desperately. In fact, KJ and Serena said when I finished the addiction inoculation, they were like, oh my gosh, you like cranked. You could write like 10 books in the next year. And I was like, no, I can't, because the reason I cranked on that book was that the deadline was looming and I needed to be able to get it in. So I completely understand that way of thinking. It makes sense to me. All right. I want to move on to this new topic. I need to move on to something very, very important because you two kind of blew my mind a little while ago when you announced your new big project. And I'm not even going to try to describe it. I'm going to let you give your elevator speech because I'm sure I'll get some detail wrong, but your next project is amazing. What are you doing?
Our next project is something we've been working on for a number of years and have only just recently been able to share because so many moving pieces had to come into focus. But
like
our
a million, I would assume. A million moving pieces.
Yeah.
A million moving pieces. So we are going to spend the 2022-23 school year living in a tiny home school bus.
And again, let me repeat, these two wonderful people have four wonderful children. Four wonderful children.
And it's not even the largest school bus out there. So the plan is to do a cross-country road trip in which we visit and do author-illustrator presentations in Title I schools in all 50 states, giving presentations about creativity and collaboration and giving out a hardcover book to every student and teacher that we meet. That's the
one
goal.
Of our hardcover books. So a book that we have written
right.
as the author illustrators who are coming to visit their
so
school.
That the students can connect our presentation to us as creators, the book to that context, and feel the accessibility that comes from having the idea that authors are sort of a distant mystical presence taken away. And we've done this over and over again over the past couple of years. Do you want to talk about our
So we've done individual school visits, and we live in a school district. Our kids go to a Title I school where the FARMS rate, which is what you use to measure what a Title I school is, so FARMS is free and reduced meals. The FARMS rate at our local elementary school is 88%. So these are, you know, kids and families and schools who are just generally underfunded for the most part. They have a lot of needs, and most of the teachers in a lot of cases are overworked, and the administrators are stretched thin, and they have so many issues that they're dealing with that planning an author visit alone is difficult, but getting authors to come visit is also difficult. They don't have the funding to pay for authors to come visit. So we have done a number. We started out doing school visits when we started doing commercial publishing, and we would get paid for it, and we would go, and it was great, you know, you're connecting with kids and the kids are so excited to see you and everybody. And then afterwards they have a book fair and kids are buying your book at the book fair and they want you to sign it and all of that. But after a while we started realizing that these were kids for the most part who had lots of opportunities and that we weren't reaching kids who didn't have opportunities and who couldn't go to the book fair afterwards and buy a book. So our first one we planned at our local elementary school, which is the elementary school that I went to growing up.
That's right. Robbie and I both went to Title I elementary schools too, so this is a lifelong and personal issue for us. We basically set up a fundraiser online said that we wanted to raise money to buy a book for every student at our local school. And within 24 hours, we had raised $3,500 to do it. And so we did it. We did a school visit. We did a couple of assemblies. We did our picture book for the younger kids, the Real McCoys for the older kids. We visited every classroom and signed the books and gave hugs. And the response in unsolicited testimonials from the principal, the teachers, the parents, and the students just was overwhelming. And it was the principal saying, here was a kid who was in my office every day for misbehaving, who came to my office the day after your visit saying he was on chapter 7 of the book and could he skip recess so he could keep reading. Teachers saying the themes you presented created really excellent talking points for me to tie what we're working on in classroom to an exciting context that enables me to give it more energy and relevance to the kids. To kids saying, and this is the thing that hits me the hardest, like, you gave me a real book. I've never had a tough book before. And that's what they meant by a hardcover book. None of them owned hardcover books. And to them, it was a special object worthy of investigation because of that. Parents wrote about the excitement that their students were feeling about reading. So it was a really meaningful moment. Not long after, someone in a local community, a teacher in a neighboring county, said, we loved what you did there. What if I raise money to do an all-school book giveaway at our school? So we volunteered our time and went to that school and did the same thing. And we've done it about 12 times now in 5 different states. And it always feels the same way. And the results we hear afterwards are always the same. We know that this is any author will tell you, I'm sure you have the same experience in your context. There's tremendous excitement generated by someone coming into a room, talking about something they created, talking about the associated themes. And for these kids, right at this moment where they are forming their relationship with reading, at this moment where they are deciding whether or not to embrace the creativity that's implicit in all of us, this is the moment where they almost stop writing and drawing and become adolescents and decide that's not something that they need to do. So really nurturing that and valuing that creative impulse is what we're trying to do. Jess, it's just the most meaningful thing that we have done as authors. And so we kicked around the idea, how do we scale this? How do we make this a bigger project? How do we not just access these local schools and states, but how do we show that this is a national problem worthy of national attention, that no matter where you live in this country, there is a school just down the road from you that has tremendous need and where you can make an impact by getting involved directly or through politics or however. We can't fix this problem, but we can draw attention to it. And that's the point. So we're going to go on this adventure with our family and our kids that will be, on one hand, the ultimate field trip that we really want to encourage people to follow along. We're going to be doing a lot of posting. I'll be doing a little essay every day about our travels. Robbie will be doing sketches. Our daughter is going to do a little video on each of the 50 states. So through the sort of kid's eye, the country, so we have a lot of different lenses through which we're going to be traveling and interacting with communities. Do you want to talk about the research project at all?
That's another thing. We also have partnered with Washington College, their education department, saw that we were doing this trip and recognized that there was a potential for a lot of really interesting data collection that has never been gathered before on one-time educational sort of extracurricular experiences. We're trying to measure outcomes of of author visits, but you know, not, it's, the literacy outcomes are predictably sort of negligible. You're not going to see people's test scores change over one school visit, but what it can do for the school community to have an all-school book giveaway, to have the authors come visit. A lot of the schools that we're going to be visiting will have never had an author visit before.
Not just the impact on the students, yes, but our research partners are really interested in what these visits do for teachers also. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity to fill a major gap in the literature about this topic, because it's really hard to measure, because there are very few instances where there's such a wide-ranging opportunity to sample kids in so many different places in a relatively short amount of time. So that's a component of this research project.
And hopefully another great outcome of this research would be for authors who might be able to say, hey, you know, sure, my publisher is sending me to this school to go give a talk, What I would love to do, and what has been proven to be really impactful, is to also do a book giveaway. So maybe can I get funding for a book giveaway at the same time? So I'm also interested in helping authors figure out more ways to have deeper impact with their books. So,
and to substantiate that impact with data that might actually persuade those.
We hope that's what the data proves.
We do. We'll see. I think we know that this is a thing that really moves the dial, and it'll be nice to see if we can back that up with
numbers. It's really hard to describe to people who haven't been into a school and seen it themselves what an impact it makes on individual kids.
You're preaching to the choir here, because every time I've ever done a Title I school, I've had kids tell me, number one, it's the first time they've ever met a writer, that writers, and I learned my lesson the first time I shipped a whole bunch of books thinking, okay, I'll sell these books there after my talk, it'll be great, blah, blah, blah. And I realized after, 5 minutes, I can't sell these books. I just can't ask these people who are so underfunded for money. And so I ended up giving all of those books away. And, those have been some of my favorite teaching and speaking experiences I've ever had. So I'm right there with you on this. I'm so behind your project. How do people, if they want to do a couple of things, number one, if people want to support this project, you have a GoFundMe and you have a nonprofit partner if someone wants to take the tax break. So where are those and how do people find those?
So the best place to go is busloadofbooks.com. Busload, because we're taking a bus, and it's like buttload is kind of funny.
Bobby, that's
funny
not the
joke.
Association we want people to make. Busloadofbooks.com.
Busloadofbooks.com.
We'll take you to the GoFundMe page. At the very top of the GoFundMe page, in all caps, is if you want to make a tax-deductible donation, go here. So there's a link there. So both links are easy to get. And sure, we'd appreciate
it. If someone just wants to follow along and see what's going on, where can they do that? Same place?
So the best place to go is our Instagram, which is robbie.and.matthew. And Robbie is spelled R-O-B-B-I.
We're going to give all the links. We're going to give all the links. And you do have the best Twitter handles on the planet. Writing Matthew and Drawing Robbie, I believe, are your Twitter handles. Yeah,
Twitter continues to baffle us,
We're not so great at Twitter.
Don't look to Twitter for greatness from us.
But we also have our individual Instagram accounts at Writing Matthew and Drawing Robbie. We also have a YouTube channel, which is, if you search for Robbie and Matthew.
It's a great place to see multiple versions of that Daily Minute video that Jess mentioned.
Yes, that goes back to the beginning of time.
We can't quite understand why people enjoy watching it as much as they do, but we do it every day. We love doing it. It's a good practice, and it's a good way to keep track of it.
I'm sorry, but one of my favorite aspects of your online presence has not been happening, and I would like to call you to the mat now. Because Matthew Draws has not been happening because I won one once. I won won as soon as you started to draw some eyelashes. I knew you were going Kim Kardashian, and I won.
Okay.
And this, I will say that most of Matthew's drawings are not identifiable as humans, let alone specific humans. But I enjoy it very much.
There's an unrealized illustrator inside of me, friends, and occasionally I exercise this impulse by selecting photographs of well-known celebrities, attempting to render them in my unintelligible scrawl, and then putting up online quizzes where people have to wager who the identity is. So you're not the only one who has lamented the
absence. I miss it.
Absence.
I do miss it. So I'm
going
to
do
busy.
It.
I understand that you're busy,
I'm
going to
do it. I'm
going to
do it. I'm going to do it so that your listeners can find a fresh batch of Matthew draws.
Oh, good. Okay. There's usually one identifiable thing that, like, if you know this person has weird teeth, you're like, oh, there are the weird teeth, and, whatever. Okay.
But I'm going to get back at you by drawing you, Jess.
To
draw you.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. But then I get to frame it. You have to keep it for me. I got to frame it because I need on my wall behind me.
There you go.
I'm going to need a picture of me drawn by Matthew.
This is what you get.
We have run long because there's so much amazing stuff to talk to you about. Go fund their project if you would like to. Again, that's at busloadofbooks.com. And if you want to follow along, you can find them at their Instagram or at their YouTube. And we're going to link to all of these in the show notes. And thank you. Number one, thank you for the books you put out into the world because they're wonderful. But thank you so much for just being such a champion for literacy and books and kids and reading, and I have attended your presentations for little kids, and the kids just, they revel in it. And especially since, if you ever get a chance to go see one of their presentations, you should, because the slides are just killer. They just make me laugh so hard. So anyway, thank you two so much.
Thank you, Jess.
Thank you,
Jess.
Thanks
for this,
opportunity.
Really
awesome. Yeah,
just nice to hang out with you.
Yeah.
We'll keep our listeners posted. We'll have show notes on all of this, including ways to, you know, find them, find their books, all that sort of stuff. And until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop. Thank you.